Hey, everybody, welcome back to the show. It's episode 121. Today, we're going to talk about the Obama strike and what it could do to some of the CITES implementation. We're going to talk about a place that I discovered to find some wood, the brittleness that we might encounter in trees, some fast-growing trees, and our featured species, which is the American hornbeam over there. Over there. One of these days, I'll get that right. Right there. Ah, never mind. So welcome to the show. As I said, this is episode 121, and thank you for tuning in. I am always really appreciative to get the questions and the emails from you guys. A lot of the show is derived directly from those questions. Today's show is no different. So if you do have questions for the show, just go over to the website, lumberupdate.com, or you can find me on Instagram at lumberupdateshow. You can email me at lumberupdate@gmail.com. And of course, a big thank you to all the sponsors of the show. If you want to sponsor the show and be like one of the cool kids, go to patreon.com/lumberupdate. But enough of that. Let's get into my my notes here. So I mentioned some places to find wood, right? And I was out for a ride on my local rail trail, which is the Torrey C. Brown Rail Trail. It just runs north straight out of Baltimore, runs up into Pennsylvania, and turns into, I think it's called the Heritage Trail in Pennsylvania, runs all the way to New York. It's a great 20-mile one-way trip up to the Maryland border. Beautiful rail trail, crushed stone. I can ride it on my road bike, I can ride it on my gravel bike, whatever. It's just a whole lot of fun. It's in a slight uphill grade the whole way. Long story short, I was riding along the trail about a week after a pretty big storm blew through the area, and there was lumber everywhere in log form. Now, I know that there are all kinds of local organizations that take care of the trail. I'm showing you the website for the Rails to Trails Conservancy. I'm actually a member of that, and I know they organize trail cleanups all the time. I think in some ways it's kind of like the adopt a highway type thing, where there'll be certain clubs that adopt certain sections or certain clubs that adopt the whole trail. In the case of the Torrey C. Brown Trail, it's quite a substantial length, but there are other rail trails that are only, 2-3 miles long, even less than that. So as a tree falls down onto the trail, someone goes out, cuts it up, and moves those little sections aside. And I tell you what, there was some beautiful lumber, whether you're into turning blanks or smaller boxes or things like that. Lots of rounds that were anywhere from 24 down to about 12 inches long. But the other thing is if you're actually a part of one of these cleanup crews, you could actually choose how I'm going to buck this out. And maybe you want a 6 or 8 foot section of log. Now, you're not going to be able to move that out of your own accord, but certainly if you were able to split it and move some pieces out, you could certainly do that. I know with a rack on the back of my bike, I was able to pick up a small round that I'm going to turn a bowl or two out of. It's just another source. This is an urban lumber source that if you have a bandsaw mill, this could be a possibility. You can check into who is cleaning this up, and you might reach out to the Rails to Trails Conservancy. Obviously, this is a North American thing. I know that there are trails and trail groups like this all over the world. Just go to bikepacking.com and you'll find trails listed all over the world. That's just the first one that comes to mind. But to me, this is not only a service to help clean up the trail, but it also could be a source for logs that you could turn into lumber, which I think that's pretty cool. So moving on here, this one's a particular interest to me. This is, moving around sharing screens here. IBAMA, that is the Brazilian Forestry Ministry. And IBAMA recently went on strike. Their workers said, hey, you got to pay us more. And they went on strike, which caused quite a few problems. First of all, it's IBAMA that contracts to firefighters. And as they were coming into the dry season, they were concerned that there were no firefighters going to be on the payroll. Who's going to fight these fires? Second of all of the inspections, the lumber inspections, the rainforest inspections, there are drones flying over flown by IBAMA employees or possibly third party entities or NGOs or something, but they report to IBAMA and say, hey, there's a hole in the canopy over here. There's not supposed to be any logging there because all of this is mapped out. I spoke about this before. You have to have 40-year concession plans. So if there's a little hole in the canopy and that's not supposed to be where a tree is taken down, it gets reported to IBAMA and IBAMA sends someone out physically to investigate and crack down on somebody who's not supposed to be there, AKA illegal loggers. Well, IBAMA was on strike. All of those people checking up on this stuff wasn't happening. Moreover, all of the people doing inspections at the various ports, at the various checkpoints, those were IBAMA employees and they were not doing anything. So it was the Wild West suddenly for the lumber industry. Well, that up until now, we're coming up on a deadline for the IPE and the Kumru CITES Appendix 2 levying or effectiveness date. And they still don't have their documentation in order. And with no one working, that was a real problem. And I say was because they are back to work now. I don't know the exact date. They went on strike in early February. As I'm recording this now, it's the middle of March. They are back to work, but there's real problems with not just CITES legislation, but with lumber export in general. There is a particular document, call it a passport, if you will, that needs to be checked by an IBAMA employee. Previously, they could view a lot of documentation and they could kind of stamp it and send it on its way. Now, the return to work IBAMA employees are saying, we have to physically be there and inspect everything before the stamp is applied, which sounds great, but there's only like five guys that can do that. Now, that's an exaggeration, but it's not a large number of people doing this. So basically, lumber export from Brazil has almost stopped. So while they're back to work from the strike, it's not that, it's not moving along that well, which is kind of startling when you think about all of the material that is flowing out of Brazil on a day-to-day basis. So anyway, I'll update as that comes along. We'll be really curious to see if they can get their act together because honestly, IBAMA does a really good job. They have incredible tracking systems for all of the lumber. They're tied in with all the various NGOs. They've got third-party auditors, really making sure that everything runs smoothly. And when they went on strike, man, did that show throw a wrench into the machine there. Next is something that, it's a little bit upsetting, frankly, because a very old company, Allegheny Forest Products, well, yeah, they're old. They closed like with little to no warning. Something like 850 people in West Virginia lost their jobs from this. And I bring this up, first of all, it's upsetting, certainly. Man, look at all the pop-ups showing up on this little site. This is a West Virginia Metro News site. Anyway, it's another example of the razor-thin margins in the lumber industry. And I've talked about how a lot of Canadian sawmills have closed. This is not unheard of inside the United States. And it's not unheard of in other parts of the world either. Razor-thin margins, the slightest little blip in the industry, aka COVID, I wouldn't call that a slight blip, but anything that can come up can cause major problems. Now, I still don't know the whole story about why Allegheny Forest Products closed, but it's a major supplier on the Eastern Seaboard for all kinds of softwood and hardwood lumber and a major employer for West Virginia. And unfortunately, they closed. So it's one of those things where you have to think, man, what's going to happen when a large employer like this, like no one is safe, not to mention the small feeder sawmills that are feeding into Allegheny Forest Products. They certainly sawed a lot of their own lumber, but they also bought sawn lumber from a lot of other people within their network. So it's a very tenuous web, and it really is kind of terrifying when something like this falls apart. So my condolences to whatever caused the closure of the whole company, but all the people that I know personally who've lost their jobs. Hopefully you will land on your feet. And hey, you're still looking for a job and you want to come up to the Baltimore region, give me a call. Maybe we can work you out because we are hiring at this point. Moving on. Let's just tackle our featured species here. It's an American hornbeam. This is a cool wood. The walnut tier supporters at Patreon support the show. Get that sticker. I'll be mailing that out shortly after I publish this episode. But American hornbeam is interesting because it's one of the hardest indigenous North American species. And any of you who have Lee Nielsen chisels have experience with American hornbeam, because that is the wood they use for their socket handles and their socket chisels. I personally have been using my Lee Nielsen chisels for more than a decade, and they still look new. You know, the wood has a, you know, patina to it, some oxidization, but they do not, they're not dinged or beat up whatsoever. It's because that has a hardness of 1780, which is pretty dang hard, harder than hard maple, harder than oak. I can't remember persimmon. Persimmon, I think, is way up there in the 2300 or 2500s, but it's definitely one of the harder North American domestic species. It's sometimes known as musclewood. And if you look at the trunk of the tree, it's very sinuous. It looks like, you know, somebody flexing. You can see a very, very thin bark, something like a beech, not beech, a birch or possibly a sycamore, without the flaking side of things. But it's, you know, ropey and sinuous like muscles. That's why it's called musclewood. It's actually a relatively small tree. All in all, I would think, let me get my notes here. In some respects, it almost kind of is like an ornamental tree in that it's only about 40 feet tall and about 2 feet in diameter. If you go to Colonial Williamsburg, these suckers are everywhere. If you like take the path from the visitor center over to the plantation, you will pass hundreds of these hornbeam trees. I sometimes, when the leaves aren't in like this time of year, I sometimes confuse them with crepe myrtle, because crepe myrtle has that kind of same sinewy bark. The hornbeam certainly gets larger, at least in diameter, and certainly it, you know, it leafs out and a totally different tree. It's kind of got a serrated edge leaf, and it's down there at the bottom of that sticker. They're all across the eastern seaboard of North America. You will find them just kind of moving into the Midwest, but they're mostly Eastern North American tree. The wood is kind of creamy white to pale brown, and you will find a lot of sapwood because this is a relatively narrow tree. Here is a piece of hornbeam. I actually put some leather on the bottom. This is actually something I will sometimes use under my holdfast. So I'll set my project piece on the bench, put this on top, and then hit the holdfast on top, and it prevents from damaging it. This has been used for, again, a decade, and you can see not a whole lot of damage on that surface from an iron holdfast. Here is hornbeam. It's a big old chunk of the stuff. This side actually has a little bit of a boiled linseed oil finish on it. You can see a little bit of spalting in there. It's not uncommon to see spalting, but generally this is what it tends to look like. This is actually about an 8-quarter blank here. I have been slowly whittling this down. This used to be about 3 inches wider, and it used to be about 5 feet long. I've been using it over the years. I've built some boxes with it. I've turned some stuff with it. I've made socket handles because I love my Lee Nielsen ones. Obviously, you saw those little holdfast things I've made. I've done a boxing inlay on an old restoration plane with one of these. Turned a bunch of stuff from, you know, pens. I've got some pens. I turned a small bowl, like a sauce, like a sake bowl out of it, a bunch of stuff. But this is actually the only piece that I've ever owned. And I've been, you know, this is all that's left of it, just about 2 feet and, I don't know, 4 inches wide, good thick bunch of it. It's not impossible to find because it does grow pretty widespread, but it's not really a commercially available species. It is a species you're going to find as you move closer to the Northeast, because that's where it's going to grow a little bit more. But again, certainly, as I said, it's all over Colonial Williamsburg, which is certainly not the Northeast. That's much further south. As I mentioned, it's got a Janka hardness of 1780, MOR 16,300, MOE about 1.7 million. Density on this, 0.58, 49 pounds per cubic foot. Very, very high. It's the highest domestic, North American domestic species that we've talked about at this point. It does kind of move a lot. It's got a TR ratio of 2.0, 11.4 tangential, 5.7 radial. The pieces that I've used have been so small that it's never really been an issue. When I made it in a box, they've been relatively thin, and it's not really been much of an issue, but it is something to think about. It will move on you. No issues as far as construction, other than the fact that it's super, super hard. You know, it takes finish beautifully, glues beautifully, all that stuff. It's used a lot for handles, tool handles. As I mentioned, chisels already from Lee Nielsen. Used for a lot of turnings. It holds details incredibly well. People love to turn with hard maple. Well, this is 300 to 400 pounds per square inch harder than hard maple. It's used a lot for wooden wheels, and I've seen it used for bearings in some respect. The unfortunate part about hornbeam, and this is where most of it goes, is as a fuel wood, and certainly firewood, but also for like wood burning stoves. It can be used for pellet wood. It can be ground up into chips, and it burns very hot because it's so dense. And just in general, I actually have a question that touches on firewood a little bit later. The denser the wood, generally the hotter it will burn, but also the slower it will burn. So as a fuel wood, you can take a piece of hornbeam, stick it in the wood burning stove, and it's gonna burn longer and hotter. So you can use much less of it to produce more heat over a longer period of time. But it's also one of those things where if you stick a big old hunk of it in the wood burning fire, you might have to leave the house because things will get so hot. Because the tree grows relatively small, it's one of those things where you can expect your hornbeam to be chopped down to clear room for other things and used for fuel wood in that respect. So I don't know, maybe I need to build some wheels, solid wood wheels, like, you know, rollerblade wheels or something like that. But as I mentioned, I've turned it mostly, a little bit of small flat work, but mostly we're talking turning. From an alternative, certainly I think beech is kind of an obvious one. From an appearance perspective, but also from a density, from a diffuse porous nature. I didn't mention it is a diffuse porous wood. Lots of very tiny pores, and they're kind of arranged diagonally through the wood, diagonal groupings, not quite radial groupings, but sometimes they're essentially solitary pores, but they're very close together and arranged diagonally across the wood. That's pretty distinctive of them. The parenchyma is also found in those diagonal bands. So like the webbing between those diagonal pores is the parenchyma, if you will. The rays are tiny. They're pretty much invisible, but they sometimes can be grouped tightly together. So you get this really fat ray, and that's actually an aggregate ray rather than being one fat ray. It's like 15 rays all grouped together. You will find some Tylos. It's not, you know, chock full like a black locust or white oak, but certainly you will see it from time to time. It's not unheard of. Alternatively, as I said, beech, hard maple also comes to mind. European hornbeam, very, very, very similar. Boxwood is another one, very dense, harder. Boxwood is harder, but it's got a similar kind of creamy, practically no grain look to it. Birch and beech, yeah. Birch is going to be not nearly as hard, a little bit more grainy than it, but still, it's similar enough. And of course, hop hornbeam, as the name indicates, it's its close cousin. Hop hornbeam is going to be browner, have a little bit more of a grainy pattern to it, but again, very similar. I don't know if hop hornbeam is in the Carpinus genus or not. In case I didn't mention American hornbeam, the one we're talking about here is Carpinus carolinian. I'd have to look. I don't recall off the top of my head whether hop hornbeam is in the same genus or not. But again, the common name does tell you that there are certainly some similarities. This is a species that, again, there's no real market rate for it. And because of the smaller size, it's never really going to be produced a lot of lumber. This is more of a harvest-it-yourself type tree. You're going to find this tree, now that I've talked to you about it, and that muscle wood, you're going to see it in a lot of places. And, you know, pull out your picture this app, which I've got right here on my phone, and you can identify that and make sure that it is actually American hornbeam relatively quickly. But I think you'll be able to find it in fair enough, and maybe even on your own property, because you don't want to go to your neighbor's property and harvest the trees. But I think it'll be a situation where you can find yourself coming into the stuff. And because it's so hard and so dense, it's not one you're going to be using for like an entire cabinet. It's more of an accent wood for turning accents and things like that. But it's still a species that shouldn't be overlooked, if for no other reason than the fact that your Lee Nielsen chisel handles are made out of it. And if you're looking to make chisel handles, it is an outstanding option. Way better than that baked maple stuff that the guys up north are using. Actually, I don't know that they're using that anymore. I think they use resin infused. Talking about Lee Valley. Sorry, Robin Lee. I don't know. Maybe they are still using modified or baked maple. I think they use resin infused stuff now. But I've been so happy with my Hornbeam Lee Nielsen handles. But what I've got, you know, my cabinet's unopened at the moment. The cabinet over there. I think I've got 3 chisels in there. I know that I've made 4 handles. One of those handles is at the Stepping Stone Museum where I was volunteering. Outstanding stuff for making handles. So anyway, let us move on, shall we? And of course, those stickers, as I mentioned, you want one of those stickers, support the show. Anybody who sponsors the show and is an active sponsor in the month of March will be getting one of those stickers. And that's exactly what it looks like. By the way, this episode, I am actually doing a video recording. This at the same time. So if you are listening to this in your car and you're being like, what's he talking about? What's he pointing to? I am also doing a video of this. The audio version will still go out to your podcast feeders, but this is going to be dropping on my YouTube channel at the same time. I just figured, why not? I'm sitting here in front of the computer when I record these. I might as well go ahead and turn on the camera and throw a little visuals in place. Certainly the feedback for the video version of Wood Talk has been nice. It's worth a shot for this one as well. Okay, move on to question. And this is from, I'm going to say Giles. Giles is in the UK. He first has a comment. It says, I've recently been listening to episode 104 about European beech and a great reference to some UK/European woods. I hadn't realized how similar USA hard maple is to beech in some ways. Yes, a great observation. So many online resources talk about hard maple when I'm surrounded by beech. Please do more European/UK wood. I absolutely will be doing that, Giles. I actually have several of those species stickers that I've already printed up that have European woods in them. I won't tell you which ones, but I'm definitely trying to, obviously I'm in North America. These are the woods that I come into contact with the most. I like to have some personal experience with the wood when I talk about it. It's not always possible, but I also have severely neglected the folks down under. So I will probably be doing an Australian species before I do another European one, but there's a lot of European species out there. I certainly would be doing that. I'm trying to get around the globe as much as possible, but obviously being in North America, that's where most of my species experience comes from. When I run out of those, I'll be leaning much heavier on other parts of the world. But if nothing else, it gives me an excuse to get more woods that I haven't worked with. But he goes on and says, European beech is infamous El Guapo, infamous European beech. It's infamous for dropping branches, big ones, at random, not during a storm. Any reasons or ideas why? I've seen huge branches drop off on nice days. Other trees normally only break in a storm. So the easy answer is the strength of the wood. And in general, the denser the wood, the more brittle it can be. There are certainly denser ring porous, and it's safe to say that the densest woods out there are ring porous woods. There are some hardwoods like hickory, like oak, that are ring porous, not diffuse porous. Did I just transpose that? The densest woods are generally diffuse porous. I think I said that, maybe I didn't. But some of them are ring porous, but like hickory is very, very hard. Wingate is very, very hard with wide open pores. But generally, the diffuse, really small pored, scattered throughout, really, really hard, high density woods are going to be more brittle. Now, some of those trees have compensated by their morphology, by how they grow. Some other trees still continue to branch out, and they, in some instances, do it on purpose as a way to drop their branches. As a tree grows up and it gets taller, it doesn't necessarily need those lower branches. Those branches are essentially requiring food, and the tree wants to drive more food up into the canopy, so it will actually intentionally drop those branches. Some of that can be an adaptation to trees that, you know, shoot up for sunlight. Or trees are growing in densely forested areas, and they don't want to waste nutrients, you know, passing it into those branches. So a tree will compartmentalize. It will block off that section, and the tree, essentially the branch dies and it falls off. So some of that you may be seeing, that's the tree compartmentalizing. In other instances, the tree is actually stressed and weakened. And because it's stressed and weakened, it is compartmentalizing certain areas to try to get more nutrients up into the part of the tree that's going to give you the most bang for the buck. A branch further down that maybe is not getting as much sunlight will be compartmentalized and it will fall off and the tree doesn't have to feed that section anymore. Sounds kind of brutal, right? But that's what the tree is doing. Other trees are just known to be brittle. Willow comes to mind. I have a willow variant. I'm looking out my window right now. It's called an Oss tree. It's a variant between black willow and... I don't remember. I'll look it up at some point. But willows in general tend to be quite brittle. They will drop branches, like you say, on a sunny day. Horse chestnut, tree of heaven, bottle brush, Russian olive. The poplar tree is also a brittle one. Magnolia is another brittle one, southern magnolia. Magnolia grandiflora, that's the one that's more brittle. Your chestnut oak, I hear about that one all the time, is quite brittle. Locust is another one. Anything in the willow frame, anything in the Salix genus. And this, you know what? The Siberian elm is another one that's brittle, but my willow, my Oss tree, I believe is an elm and willow variant or hybrid, if you will. Those are two very brittle woods. And that's why it drops, those Oss trees drop branches all the time. I keep looking out the window, seeing some of the branches in my yard that I have to clean up. I would think what you're seeing, I mean, beech is a diffuse porous, small pored, high density wood, it's going to have those issues. But what may also be causing it is just stress on the tree itself that's causing it to drop. But in general, the denser the tree, the more brittle the wood will be. There will always be exceptions to the rule, but European beech is not one of those exceptions, certainly. He does have another question here. He says, there are a lot of firewood options out there. And he says, there's a lot of Tom, Dick, and Harry on YouTube covering it. Different levels of knowledge. You've previously explained how wood is like a bundle of straws. Would logs dry noticeably faster if they were stored vertically? Yes, I've talked about this in the past on the show. It's called gravity drying. A lot of sawmills out in the forest, whether it's in the jungles of South America or Africa or in Canada, because those logs have to be moved a distance before they're sawn, or in some instances, they're sawn quickly, but then they have to be moved a distance before they can put on a truck. They will be stored vertically, usually in A-frame structures, and it will drain out the free water. That helps to dry a little bit, but also dramatically reduces the weight, meaning you can fit more onto a flatbed as to move somewhere else. You can fit a log, more logs on a flatbed if you drain some of that water out. Gravity drying is the solution there. He goes on to say, rotten or punky firewood, does it have any value and can it ever dry, quote, back into firewood? The answer is no, it can't dry back into firewood. Punky and rotten wood is not water, although water helps. And I've spoken about this in a very recent episode. The water is what's promoting the growth of the bacteria, of the algae, of the fungus. It's attracting the bugs that are eating the wood, that's causing the wood to rot. Water alone is not rotting wood. In fact, water by itself can make the wood even more durable because it makes it more spongy and, you know, more flexible, less brittle. But it's the water that breeds all the other stuff that eats and rots the wood itself. So once you've got bacteria and stuff in there, if you dry it out, what do you have? You have dry rot. No. So you can't really turn that back into a usable lumber. And the firewood stuff, that's why it tends to stay firewood at that point. Sorry, Giles had quite a few questions there. We should allow that. Too bad I already did it. Dave has an interesting question and actually some feedback here that I'm going to kind of throw into a conglomerate because I got a lot of responses. I talked about that family in Portland, Oregon who had a tree fall in their house. And I don't think I was clear on my response here because I had a couple of people like, you know, I can't believe you're not siding with this family. And other people like, you know, you're completely heartless. It's not what I'm saying at all. I understand why a city might need to regulate what trees get taken down because, you know, you could just have trees taken down willy-nilly and the urban canopy is a big deal. At the same time, I really feel for the family, like, oh my God, if it were my house, I would be furious. I'd be hopping mad. I had somebody who wrote in and said, you know, what if you had a kid in that house? Absolutely. I feel for this family. I don't think that they are wrong in being upset at all. it's finding that balance. And it's really hard to say. It was more that I wanted to kind of shine a light on the fact that I was unaware that these kind of regulations existed. So in response to Dave's question, a lot of people have written in, given very specific examples in their neighborhoods. I've heard from Texas, Florida, California, Michigan, Ohio, New Jersey, actually from here in Maryland, that yes, there are bodies that control it. In Maryland, I heard it was more of a county specific thing. I don't know that I have that up in my county, but it's very common. In other words, I've just been under a rock apparently. So what Dave is saying here, I've heard from a lot of you all around the country. So thank you. Thank you for that feedback. Dave says, I live in Southwestern Florida. And when my neighborhood was built, the developer had to get a development plan approved by the city. This plan included a whole bunch of items, including that certain numbers and categories of trees needed to be on each lot. They didn't need to be the same, but there is a requirement of at least one canopy tree and three palm trees per lot. That's actually good to say, because palm trees grow super, super fast, and they're kind of ornamental, and people, and they're cheap. People are like, yeah, throw some palm trees on there. There also needs to be either a second canopy tree or two ornamental trees. To save money, the developer decided to go with the second canopy tree rather than the ornamental trees, which meant that almost every house in the neighborhood had an oak tree in its front yard, which is going to end up getting blown into the houses during a serious hurricane. Although you dismiss the likelihood of serious house damage in Oregon, I would point out that this particular neighborhood has seen two major hurricanes since 2017. Again, what do I know? Replacing that oak tree with two smaller ones was fairly simple, as I just had to fill out a form and attach a map of the lot showing where the new trees would be going in to have my homeowners association approve the project. Because this situation was governed by the development plan rather than a local ordinance, I only had to get it approved by my HOA rather than by the city. HOAs justifiably get a bad rap, but in this case, it was better than having the city in charge. So what Dave has said, I've heard the same thing where the HOA wasn't in charge and it was the city, and several other people said it was the HOA. But this particular one is the most detailed one, where there was a development plan and they laid out the types of trees. To me, that's really cool, because I mean, even in Dave's situation, the developer wanted to save money. So he's like, let's plant some oak trees. Let's plant canopy trees. They're super cheap as compared to, like, you know, a Japanese cherry or an apple or, hornbeam, crepe myrtle. They're much more expensive and they're slower growing for that matter. But that, I like seeing this. And a little hint for the future, I've been talking to some folks here in Baltimore, because Baltimore actually has a pretty amazing urban forestry program. And I want to get some of them on the show to talk about this. This thought is happening at the city level, and it's cool to see it happening at the HOA level. Now, when it becomes difficult, when a tree becomes a threat to a house, that's where I really feel for this family in Portland. And I've heard from several others of you who have been able to say, look, I was able to get an independent arborist to come out and say, this is bad. And that arborist, you know, filled out a document and they submitted to the city, and the city then approved it. So, you know, as terrible as it was with this family in Portland, maybe if they got a third party in there to say, hey, this needs to come down, the city might have approved it. Now, the unfortunate thing there is that's on your dime, right? You've got to have, you know, your pay for the guy to come out and do it. But more than likely, you're going to have to pay to have the tree removed anyways. It sounds like that's what the city of Portland was doing to this family whose tree fell on their house. So again, thank you from everybody who wrote in on that. It was really great to hear from really every corner of the United States. I haven't heard from anybody in Europe. So European listeners, let me know. I'd be really curious there, because totally different systems sometimes. But Dave does have a question. He says, I've got about 13 to 18 years before I retire. My wife and I plan on staying on a current home until we retire and move somewhere less hurricane prone at that point. I would like to plant a tree that will make for a small amount of interesting lumber to take with me when we move. I'm aware that this isn't a huge amount of time on the life of a tree timescale. So I'm hoping to be able to make, I'm not hoping to make anything larger than, say, a small box, knife scales, or small turned items with what I get. The question is, what tree should I plant in my backyard? I have space for it to get up to about 15 to 20 feet across. It would get full sun, and we have sandy, pretty well drained soil. As we live in Southwestern Florida, we have very mild winters. very hot, humid weather most of the time. I was thinking about Lignum vitae since it's native to the Caribbean and thus would be able to handle the weather that would get thrown out of here. But I'm concerned that it might be too slow growing for the time frame that I'm looking at. So that concern is very valid. Growth rate of Lignum vitae is as little as 1 inch per year. So yeah, that's not a lot. And yeah, it grows in the Caribbean, but I would be really, I don't know, I would have to look more into the growing habits of that particular species, but I can tell you the slower growing ones are going to be really difficult in what did he say, 13 to 18 years? 13 to 18 years. I would actually look at a faster growing tree here and look at certainly what's going to grow, first of all, well in Florida. Assuming that you've got a somewhat tropical climate, you might actually look at genuine mahogany. It's certainly faster growing and with the right conditions. I've known a lot of people growing genuine mahogany, the Sweetina macrophylla, in Florida, all across Florida, from the Panhandle down to Miami, and it grows quite quickly. That would be an interesting species. Honestly, though, cypress, super fast growing tree. And you know, Leland cypress grows all over natively across Florida, and you can actually get some really interesting wood. There are, I'm looking at a website here, river birch, any of the river or swamp species are going to be fast growing. Red maple is another one that grows relatively quickly for its density. Willows grow really fast, but again, they can be quite brittle, but you can get some interesting lumber coming out of it. I'd like to feature a willow or two in the coming years or coming months. Silver maple is another one that grows relatively fast, but silver maple is also one of those that has brittle branches, but that wouldn't be too much of a problem for lumber purposes. Eucalyptuses grow relatively quick. You do have to be a little cautious there, because they're essentially flammable. Look for swamp growing trees, look for willows, look for cypresses. As far as hardwoods go, yeah, willow, cedars certainly grow relatively quickly. Look for low density, fast growing trees. I mean, Polonia, the Curie tree, it can be a really attractive wood, I think personally. And man, I think it's probably the fastest growing tree in North America, and it grows like a weed everywhere. So that's the one that I would look at. If you actually want any kind of usable lumber in 10 years, 15 years, that's what you're going to be looking at. Most of your hardwoods are going to be, you know, tiny. They're not going to be very large at all. You know, there may be 6 inches in diameter after that amount of time. Maybe you could get up to about 8 inches in diameter with a slower growing hardwood, but you're going to be looking for faster growing hardwoods, or fast growing softwoods for that matter. And that being said, I think we have reached the end of the show. So yeah, interesting questions today, guys. I really appreciate the feedback on all of the stuff that I've been talking about. Everything from, you know, HOAs to trees in Europe. So keep it coming. Anytime you've got comments on any of my assumptions, or if I pose a question in the show, I'd love to hear from you. More importantly, I love that so many people write in. Never feel like, oh, I'm sure you've heard this before, I'm not going to write into them. Hearing it from a wide geographic distribution is really important when we're talking about trees and we're talking about lumber, because so much of my experience can be, you know, centered around the Mid-Atlantic or Northeastern lumber market, to the Pacific Northwest, because they get a lot of lumber from that area. So hearing from people all across the globe is really, really beneficial. So keep those questions coming. Lumberupdate at gmail.com, lumberupdate.com to submit your question. And please, if you want to be like the cool kids and get this fancy sticker, go to patreon.com/lumberupdate and you can support the show. Thanks so much, everybody. And you know what? Let's play you out.
Shannon's Lumber Industry Update.